Accession number 27767, Reel 6.
I'm exhausted, I think.
Adrian Holloway, end of Reel 5. Adrian Holloway, Reel 6. So, you went into Suda Bay.
Yes, and finally, having taken on board all the wounded, some of them very badly wounded, our doctor got busy, and we started to leave the harbour. Never have I been more glad to leave a place. The whole place smelt of death and defeat, and indeed it was only 24 hours later that the Germans took over Suda Bay. As we were going out of the harbour, which again was a very tortuous proceeding, a German plane kept coming over us and dropping flares. The flares illuminated a wide area, but fortunately, every single time he dropped one, it was just astern of the last ship, and so we crept out without having been seen. We then had about 5 or 6 hours of darkness, but as we rounded the eastern end of Crete, dawn came, and with it the Stukas and the high-level bombers. Our captain, not very renowned for good ship manoeuvring in harbour, was wonderful at avoiding the bombs, because what you had to do then was to be on the bridge, as of course he was, looking up at the sky and seeing the bomb as it left the aircraft, and on its way down you would have to judge where it was going and swing the ship to avoid it. You could do that with a destroyer because they answered the helm so quickly. First of all, it was Stukas, low-level dive bombers with their screaming sirens, and later on it was high-level bombers. The destroyer Havoc was hit, but fortunately she was able to continue, and after that we survived two attacks and were able to get back to Alexandria.
Where were you all this time? Where were you on action stations?
All my time I was in the plot. In the plot was a large table called the ARL table, Admiralty Research Laboratories. This had a small light underneath it, and the light would move in accordance with the ship's course and speed. So I had to place a chart on that and try to keep a what's called a dead reckoning position, which would later be corrected by sights. So I was under there, and occasionally the captain and navigator would come down, and if it was dark, they wanted to consult the chart, so they would open the door. The light would go out immediately because there was a catch there, so obviously you didn't want to show any lights, and that they wouldn't be blinded when they got back to the bridge. They would look at the chart and check themselves and then go on back up to the bridge. So all I really saw most of the time I didn't see much most of the time of the bombers themselves, but perhaps that was even worse because all you heard was the sudden whistle of the bomb as it came down, and you didn't know if it was going to land on you or whether it was going to land in the sea nearby.
Was there anyone else in the plot room with you?
There was a rating with me.
Uh-huh. And do you remember his name?
No, I can't remember. Right. Yeah. But when we heard the whistle of the bomb, we would crawl underneath the plot table and try and have that as some sort of protection, which had the bomb burst, of course, it wouldn't have been useless at all, but it was really a sort of animal-like reaction.
Must have seemed a very long night, wasn't it?
Oh, very long, very long. We were so tired, absolutely exhausted, because you were meant to be 4 hours on, 4 hours off. But you could never really relax because there were repel aircraft and action stations all the time. So you might just as well have stayed at your action station. When the whole of Crete had been finished, I slept for about 24 hours.
Tell me about your captain. Who was the captain?
The captain was Captain M.J. Clark, a charming man from Melbourne who showed me great courtesy. I was the only Englishman on board other than the torpedo gunner, who was a officer who'd risen from the lower deck. And I cannot say that we really were enamoured of the Australians, who, A, were always talking about somewhere where I'd never been, and B, for the most part, ignored us entirely, and were going on about the bloody Poms and this, that and the other. And eventually, I'm afraid, I was so fed up with this that I said, well, your damn country's only five cities in the desert, which didn't exactly endear me to them. There was... do you want the names of the other...
Yes, please.
The first lieutenant was a man called Dusty Miller. He was nice. He was a two-stripe lieutenant. The officer in charge of me was Lieutenant Carter, who was a lieutenant commander. Nominally, as I say, he was in charge of me, but he hardly ever spoke to me, took no interest whatsoever in my welfare, and he was rather a large, porcine man whom I grew to dislike intensely. There was a sub-lieutenant Black, whose nickname was, to the politically correct, horrific name of Nigger, which would created no trouble at all in those days. It was just the same as Nigger Brown for gloves. And he was nice, and the engineer commander was a lieutenant commander, Australian, very nice, and the doctor was charming too. But you really never had any chance to have much social converse with them, because we were almost continuously at sea, or if we were in harbour, we were refuelling and restoring and so on. And the idea of anybody actually having a placid meal was rather remote.
So how long were you on the Nizam?
I was on board Nizam for 3 months. Mm-hmm. That's the statutory time for a midshipman to do his destroyer training. Mm-hmm. And the whole of it was complete action. Mm-hmm. Because we did two more trips to Crete. By this time, the situation in Crete had completely worsened, and it was agreed by General Wavell and General Freiberg, who was in charge of Crete itself, that the island should be evacuated. Freiberg, I understand, sent a signal to Cairo saying that it's unlikely we can hold out in Suda Bay for more than 24 hours, which was quite true. So our mission when we got back to Alexandria was to quickly refuel and restore, and to take on some extra boats like whalers so that we could transport troops that were trying to escape and bring them back to Alexandria.
How did you feel about going back to Crete, having just escaped it, as it were?
I certainly didn't like the prospect. The only thing that was a rather better thought was that Sfakia was on the south coast of Crete. Previously, we'd been visiting Suda Bay, which was on the north coast, and obviously the far more dangerous. That is not to say that Sfakia wasn't dangerous as well, but it didn't involve the long voyage round the eastern part of Crete in order to get to your port. Other ships were evacuating Heraklion. They were actually able to go alongside. Now, Sfakia was a tiny tiny fishing port. I never saw it in daylight. But by dint of wonderful navigation, we got there all right. And then the gunner, the English gunner, was detailed off to go with about three or four of these whalers ashore. What was happening ashore was that some people were trying to rush the boats, and there was a four-man deep ring of bayonets to prevent anybody rushing the boats.
So what sort of landing did you have? Were you, was it a sort of sandy shore or pebbly shore, or were you up against a...
Well, as I say, I couldn't possibly see it. That was the ridiculous thing. But we dropped anchor offshore, and I suppose it was probably about half a mile that the gunner had to go with his flotilla of boats. And then, of course, when he got there, people were struggling, as in Dunkirk, to get on board, and he had to be careful that the boats weren't overloaded and didn't overturn. But mostly, good order was kept.
Did you go out with these boats?
I didn't go out with them. And
but you saw them coming back, did you?
Well, no, all you could see was I was on deck whilst they were clambering up the side. A destroyer has no sophisticated gangways like a battleship. None of the sort of angled steps. They have a steep ladder up which you've got to climb. And, of course, this was dreadful for the poor wounded. We couldn't do anything to help them. And they just have to get up as best they could. And in a sense, it was rather melodramatic, rather like a film, because practically every one of them said, thank God for the Navy. Because I had heard later on after the war that they fought all their way down. Is that all right to be related? That they fought all their way down through Greece and into Crete. And their one thought was that eventually, if they did get cornered by the Germans, the Navy would be there to rescue them. And as much as we could do, we did.
What sort of condition were some of them in?
Oh, they were very exhausted, dirty, hot. They'd had to survive a 20-mile trek across the mountains, which were high themselves, in blistering heat. And one told a story of they were all dying to have something to drink, but there was very little water. And there was a padre who was standing halfway along the long line, which they had. It was nothing more than a goat path. And he had some water with him and allowed them to take little sips. And he himself had cracked lips because he hadn't given himself one tiny bit of water to take. He kept it all for the troops. There were some who we know couldn't stand it, and they shot themselves in caves. But the awful thing for those who were left behind was that they said that the most dreadful thing was when they heard our anchor chain being hauled up. And the last visit that we made, they heard that and they knew that there would be no more rescue. They then had to face the return journey with no hope whatsoever except of being herded back into a prison camp and go to Germany, which was quite too terrible.
And when these soldiers came on board, where did they go? They were on the deck.
They went to... We put the rescued soldiers down into the mess decks. And then it was that the captain sent for me and he said, Snotty, I need to know how many men we've got, we've taken on board, because if we've got too many, we could capsize if I'm turning the ship at speed. So I went down onto the mess deck and there... These exhausted men were wolfing lovely sandwiches of white bread and ham and so on, and having tea. And they were really most grateful for that. And I looked at them and I thought, how in heaven's name am I going to count all this lot? Because they were all huddled together. And then I had quite a brainwave for me. I blew a whistle, which I had got, and I said, now listen to me, we've got to know how many of you are on board. And I didn't add what it might be the corollary, that we might send some ashore if we had too many. But I said, what I want you to do is to number from front to back. And that's what they gradually did. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I think I reported to the captain we had something like 400 on board, which was just about all that we could take. Not only were they there, of course, but they were on the upper deck as well. And this is what, as I previously said, they were so difficult to surmount their bodies when you were going and trying to get to your action station. So that was that. And
We went back to Alexandria,
and we made two trips after that. And it was the last trip. I know that Evelyn Waugh was on board, although I didn't know it at the time, because I found out from his war diary. Now, in his war diary, which is in the Imperial War Museum, he recounted the fact that he was on board the destroyer Nizam, but he said that we had an uneventful journey back to Alexandria. This is absolute rubbish. He must have been so tired, as maybe so many were, that he, in spite of the noise and everything else, he didn't hear anything. But we were actually attacked by 34 aircraft, and had not the RAF been within range, because we were near enough Egypt for them to take on the enemy, we would certainly all have been swimming. And it was a wonderful sight that the RAF appeared. You see, what had happened there was that after Crete, sailors who found any RAF men in Alexandria would beat them up, simply because they had no air cover when they were trying to evacuate Crete. It wasn't the fault of the RAF by any manner of means. The thing was that their airfields had all been taken by the enemy. So it was really very unfair, but you can understand men who had felt so much that it was really the end of their tether.
Did you see any cases of RAF people being...
I didn't see them personally, no. No, I didn't. But there is one thing. Do you want to switch it off?
Yes, I
can. On our final journey back from Alexandria, when we reached the port, sirens were sounding, bugles were blowing, and we got a right royal reception as we came into the harbour. And this was filmed, and there is a film of this in the Imperial War Museum. You can just see Nizam's number, which was G34, I think, painted on her hull. The aftermath of Crete was that we were all so desperately tired that we slept for about 24 hours.
You stayed on board,
yes. And it was rumoured, and I believe this to be true, that during the time of the evacuation of Crete, the commander-in-chief, Mediterranean Fleet, Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham, went on board one of the cruisers, which had suffered greatly. And he looked up at the funnels and so on, which were absolutely full of shell holes and so on, and said, oh, you've been peppered about a bit, haven't you? And he said to the men who were assembled before him that, well, never mind what's happened there. You've got to go out and collect the army again. And I believe that it was very touch and go that the men didn't break ranks and throw him overboard. The captain actually was dismissed because there was a sort of growl from the men, and they were very angry. And it was a very stupid thing, as Cunningham to have said, because he hadn't been in it, and they had. And apparently also, this is almost unbelievable, but it's in one of the naval books, that he got his secretary to look up the... to get out execution warrants for hanging ratings who'd refuse to go.
And was there an opinion at the time, maybe among the Australians or from yourself, as to what sort of a muddle Crete was?
Yes. It was a frightful muddle, and one felt that this was so. But the thing was that when you were actually in the battle itself and at sea, you obviously could only see a very small part of it. The trouble was that communications were virtually impossible, because the army worked on one wavelength and we worked on another. And I believe that the army couldn't communicate with parts of itself either. Radio sets were virtually useless, and I, in the plot, was given the job of being intelligence officer for the captain, and I received all the reports of ships being sunk and so on, and I had to collate these into some kind of coherent report for the captain. Well, I'd had no training in this at all, and so it was very difficult. And what was more, reports in action are not always accurate. Somebody may report something of one incident which is entire variance with another of the same thing. And the worst time was probably our last but one run. No, I'm sorry. The worst time was the time when we went to Suda Bay, because we got a signal that the cruiser Doc Gloucester, which I had seen launched by the Duchess of Gloucester in 1937, that she'd been sunk, and there were survivors in the water. And then there was the cruiser Fiji, which had gone to her help. She was also sunk. Later on, we knew, of course, that Mountbatten ship Kelly was also sunk. And it appeared that those ships were having the most dreadful time. We weren't very far from them, but actually on going towards Suda Bay, we never saw a single enemy plane. So that really is Crete. Mm-hmm.
What an experience.
It was an experience. It was a frightful experience, and one that I never want to go through again.
Did you go ashore in Alexandria afterwards? You know, what was the atmosphere like there? Because there must have been a lot of army people and navy people there.
Well, no, you see, there were virtually no army people, because I think, as I've said before, they weren't allowed into Alexandria.
Right.
We weren't allowed to. They were taken straight off, and possibly put. There was a military hospital near us. But we didn't see much of them, and we weren't allowed up into Cairo. So we had the place to ourselves.
Yeah. And what was the atmosphere like in Alexandria then? I mean,
was
it relief and have a party?
I think it was just, you know, you were so tired you didn't think. It may sound silly at this time, but you thought, well, thank God I'm alive, and what's the next job? And anyway, we didn't have much rest, because on the last occasion, when we'd been bombed by these 34 aircraft, a bomb landed very close to us, and there was a frightful crash, and all the lights went out. And what had happened was that this bomb had become too close, and it had destroyed some vital part of machinery, or rather damaged it. So although we could steam, but not at full speed, when we got back to Alexandria, we had to go into dock. that, from the human point of view, was rather ghastly, because it was a small little dock called Gabari Dock. The bigger ships would go into the floating dock, but we were in one which was actually on land. And some of the ship's company went elected to go out to a rather nice place called Sidi Bish, where you could bathe and so on. But because I had a cabin and it was such a luxury, I elected to stay on board, in spite of the fact that there was an air raid every night. But the worst thing was the flies. It was awful. They were everywhere. And I thought, well, how awful to be a Pongo, a soldier, in the desert, who has not only to cope with the enemy and so on, but sandstorms and the flies. And so I was thankful, really, that although I was beset by flies, I wasn't in the Western Desert. So we were in dock for about a week, which was certainly a relaxation. In the afternoons, when one could go ashore, I don't know whether I've said this before, but my great relaxation was the sporting club. Did I talk about it?
No, not in detail.
That was a lovely club in Alexandria, and you could bathe in the lovely swimming pool there, play tennis, and after you'd played tennis and changed, you had tea and sticky cakes waited upon by Egyptians in beautiful white flowing garments and fezes. And it was a real transportation back to almost pre-war days.
What was the building like?
I can't remember.
Right.
But it was a big sprawling complex, just like any other sporting club, and it had about six or eight tennis courts and the swimming pool. It was truly a wonderful place to go.
Change.
Absolutely. So then, in June 1941, having left our dock, there came war against the French, our former allies. And this was the most extraordinary thing. I'll have to go into the background of it, I think, or not.
Yeah, or explain where this is taking place.
Hmm. What had happened was that, once again, Iraq was in the news, as it was to be later on, and Rashid Ali, who was the Prime Minister of Iraq, was pro-German, and the Germans wished to take their troops through Iraq and to roll up the Russians from the south in the Crimea. To do this, they would have to go through Syria. And the Vichy French there were prepared to let them do that. And so for once we took the initiative and were in time, not like Norway, we invaded Syria. And so we found ourselves in the extraordinary situation of fighting our former allies. We were ordered to sail from Alexandria to Haifa. And the first thing I saw when we entered Haifa was the destroyer Isis. She was alongside being supplied with electric power because she'd been bombed. And who had she been bombed by? The French. It seemed a Gilbertian situation, and one which we were very bitter about, because they could have let us come through, but they didn't. And this is... and was a very little known war. It lasted 6 weeks, and there were 13,000 casualties on either side.
And where were you? You went into Haifa. Did you stay there? Or?
We were based in Haifa. We had no other base. But what we used to do was to patrol up and down the Syrian coast. Our first mission was to go out and to seek two French destroyers of the Kassar, C-A-S-S-A-R-D, Kassar class, which we'd heard were in the vicinity. And about 1 o'clock in the morning, alarm action was sounded, and we had found the destroyers. We fired at them, they fired at us. And what was somewhat unnerving was that they were using coloured tracer so that you could see their projectiles and so on, and machine gun fire coming towards you, which was very pretty but highly unpleasant.
Yeah, I'm going to stop you there.
Yeah.
Adrian Holloway, end of reel 6.
Oh, my gosh.